Welcome back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I'm Jason Snell, and across the internet for me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Jason.
How are things?
They are strong in TV land.
The state of TV land is strong?
Strong.
Mm-hmm. Population is
still
growing.
Yeah. Still, oh my God, still churning it out.
Yes, swelling.
Mm-hmm. Nothing we didn't know already, but yeah, I'm here to remind you. Yep, still coming.
Yep, mm-hmm. Peak TV era. So this leads us perfectly into one of these Reporter's Notebook pieces, which you wrote this week, which is about the challenge of surviving season two. And I remember you and I had a conversation a long time ago about the challenge of surviving episode two, which I think is still a thing. But, you know, you shoot a pilot and then you have to prove that it is going to be a series and you got to get through episode two. You know, fans of music know about the infamous sophomore slump. How do you make your breakthrough and then you've got to kind of like go into the long haul. And I was thinking about that as I read your piece, because the challenge of season two of any TV show is it's not season one. It's not a new show. It's not premiering. And you've got an existing audience if they know that you're back. But like, it's hard to, I started watching season two of Jessica Jones last night, and it was one of those moments of like, oh, like this show is back, right? Like, just there's so many other shows that it's really hard being a sophomore series, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think that the proliferation of streaming actually hurts cable in that way, in that what streaming has taught us, other than streaming on how to do it and the rest of the middle America, but what it's taught us is that it's always going to be there no matter when you can get to it. And since you're already paying the subscription fee, you can just get to it whenever. Well, that doesn't really help the cable world if they're actually still trying to get ratings, which, you know, some of them certainly are. But beyond that, yeah, it's just, you know, you make something, it's like writing something, you want people to see it, hear it, those kind of things. But the struggle is, you know, even if you're not in if you're on HBO and you're not essentially ratings driven, right? Still, if nobody turns out for season two of a Divorce, or season two of Crashing, or season two of High Maintenance, which I mentioned, or conversely over on Amazon, are people going to tune in for today's second season premiere of Sneaky Pete, which has been off for 14 months. You have to cut through this clutter. But it does hurt cable more, because, you know, you can say, oh yeah, like I can watch, I'll just get to Atlanta. I really loved Atlanta last season. I'll get to it. But will you? And if you don't, what does that do to FX as you're waiting? They could be, I don't know what the ratings are, but they could be thinking, oh my God, like it's not the same. Although, as I make a point in my, the argument I made in my column is that shows like Atlanta, which have had a high critical acclaim, and then also and same thing with Jessica Jones, really large and rabid fan base, those are helpful. Atlanta was off for a really long time, but it came back and it was littered with press. I mean, there was so many stories written about that. That doesn't actually happen with every show, as you know. So all these second season ones are coming back. Many of them have been off for a year. And in the streaming world and in the peak TV world, when we get new shows every day, how hard is it to remember, oh yeah, that show I kind of liked last year is now back? Season two is very difficult.
As a tech guy, I always think about the tools here too, because that's part of it, is we don't have a unified mechanism for all these shows. And in fact, it's worse now and not better, because instead of it just being maybe on your DVR, now you've got things that are streaming, and you know, those interfaces are not that easy either. I actually had this, it's a little sidelight about our discussion about trailers and recaps and stuff like that. I was, Netflix was convinced that from the banner for Jessica Jones that I wanted to watch episode one of season one of Jessica Jones. I was like, no guys, I saw all of that already. Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time finding the right tile in the Netflix interface that would let me view the list of episodes so that I could pick season two, episode one. I also realized that the reason that I was confused and surprised when they said that there's a whole trailers and more section that's got little recaps in it, right, is that I watch Netflix on the Apple TV and doesn't have those. doesn't list those. It only lists the episodes. So I actually was going to watch the Jessica Jones trailer. I was like, all right, this is good. I'm going to get my season one recap, and they're going to show me David Tennant, and he's going to be evil. And nope, they're just, it's not there. So my point, though, my larger point is, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, so how do you find, even if you use Amazon or Netflix, you got to be reminded that season two exists, and it's not going to pop up on your DVR. So, like, it's worse now instead of better, because the tech exists. It would be nice if you just got, like, a little reminder. I mean, I know there are websites and apps that do this, but you got to put in all the shows that you watch, and you forget some, and then you forget about the app. And, I mean, I've tried a bunch, and I haven't succeeded with it, but it's like, that's where we are now. It's just, it's so easy to lose track of a show. And I was talking to somebody about some show, I think it was The Magicians, which is now back for its third season. I would say, actually, I think better than ever. I think they really have killed it in season three. But, like, I like that show, and I was not aware that it was coming back. And at least that's on Sci-Fi, so my DVR caught it. And but I had that moment of, like, what?
Right.
I just, so, and then streaming is like that too. So it's this brutal, like,
yeah. So basically, anybody who's in the industry has, I think, a, you know, sticking their head in the sand view of this situation we're talking about, where second seasons and shows starting back up again are hard for people to follow. They don't want to believe that. So when they read columns like that I've written, or they even listen to this podcast, I think the reaction that they get is like, oh, people will come back, they'll be fine. Well, and my point is, yeah, they'll come back to Jessica Jones probably, maybe eventually, but you can't guarantee it. It's just really hard. People are overwhelmed, and I don't think the level of understanding how overwhelmed people are, it has permeated the industry. They're just very Pollyanna about that approach. So yeah, it's, I think it's really hard to get noticed and get picked up again after your first season. And then it's just incredibly difficult to get noticed, because a year's gone by at minimum. And people have found, oh my God, like it's hard to fathom how many shows come out in a year. And, you know, if the show that you liked in the first season was, you know, kind of like a thing, and it was one of your 10, if it wasn't your top three, what are the odds that you're going to actually remember that it's back and make the time to see it? So there's a lot of obstacles in the way of these shows.
Would it ever happen that people would start to think we'd be better off doing a bunch of one-off seasons, basically like mini series where we run through and then we go away and don't worry about a season two because we probably don't care? Would TV ever, do you think, transform to that degree where people would, like, not even bother trying to get people back for a season two and just move on to another, maybe related, maybe not, project?
I think it would be a low percentage. I would love it, a low percentage. But yeah, it's, the thing is, it's just chasing money, right? And it's hard to duplicate success. But
right.
if you have a Jessica Jones and it does work, everybody's going to want to come back. Where I do think these limited series are very appealing to people in the peak TV era, because it's like, oh, right, I can just watch these 6 or 7 or 8 episodes and then I'm done. And then I won't come back. I think shorter episodes are the way to go, and maybe see if you can close the turnaround gap. But a bigger issue is one that we talked about on this podcast. God, it's so long ago, but it was an executive, a former executive at MTV, who was, I think, then at BBC America, and he was talking to me about that the television business, the industry, has not found a way outside of, like, sci-fi shows. And I think he was referencing
Orphan Black.
Orphan Black, the clone show. Oh my God. I was just about to say Clone Wars.
The clone show.
I was like, Clone Wars is a different thing entirely. But, you know, he was just saying they do a really good job of keeping their, you know, their Orphan Black audience engaged in the off season. And I think you might remember, we talked about him saying that you need a hot stove league for television, where you're constantly in touch with your audience some way. And I brought this up at the ATX festival one time to a bunch of people, you know, Noah Hawley and it's a number of people who are making shows. And, in fact, Graham Manson from Orphan Black, and about, like, how do you keep it up in the off season? And the idea was basically, you know, Bo Willimon from House of Cards at the time was like, I don't have time for that. Forget it. That's not my job. Well, in the future, it's going to be somebody's job. And I think the series creators are going to have to be a part of it where you're like, hey, we need you to be actively involved in like either creating some kind of content or helping us keep people interested in the quote unquote off season, because then it's much harder to launch a show in the next year.
It's funny that you mentioned Noah Hawley, because I just saw the Legion season 2 trailers. And again, that's a case where FX is doing some good work in getting re-engaging with people and saying, remember Legion, you liked Legion, you want to come back and watch Legion again. And that's good, because I do. But you mentioned Sneaky Pete being off for, 14 months? It's like, mm-hmm. It goes off the radar, and there's just so much else out there, and it goes off for a long time. And it is hard, like we said in our little trailer conversation, like, it's hard to even remember what happened in these shows, even if you do remember that they existed, because the turnaround time takes so long. I don't know whether it would be better. Would it be better to do something like what Amazon did with The Tick, where they broke it in two, so that you had, I mean, you have to make the sale every time you come back, but at least it's, you know, it's back after 6 months instead of back after 14 months.
Yeah, I think there's some merit to that. Although I was a huge Tick fan, and I have not watched that second part. I think that's very telling. You know,
see?
I think that's very
telling. We watched it, but well, that's what I meant about how it cuts both ways with having to sell it, because you still have to close the deal on getting somebody to re-engage with your show at all. And so, if you're doing that twice a year, does that just increase the chance of losing a viewer by 50%, or does it help? I'm not sure whether it actually would be the right way to go there. It's a tough one, because you know, this is the problem with binge shows too, right? Is that instead of it being a 3 month break, it's a year between installments, because you're getting them in a big blob. And that's at a time when there's more competition. I don't know. It's a tough one. I can see why it's hard out there for those second year shows. I can see how that's a tough one, seeing some of them come back just in these last couple of months.
Yeah, and I think that's something I'm definitely going to be writing about in the future, because I don't know if it's one of the things that's valuable for subscription services like Amazon and Netflix, and going forward it'll be Apple and all those others, is that if you have enough there that's sitting there, then it's not so much when they think you're going to come back, and they're not as interested in when as say FX and maybe to some degree HBO, which is still watching their ratings, even they don't need to. You know what I mean? There's some benefit to saying, hey, everybody, we're Netflix. So we have this ginormous catalog of shows, all your favorites, blah, 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 mini seasons, and just come luxuriate in our little hot tub of shows and enjoy what you can when you want to do it. That's really their philosophy. So like, as much as I'm sure that they are like looking at the numbers to see if Jessica Jones people are going to come back this week, in the big picture, it's not so important. They have your money, your Jessica Jones money. You already put it in, and now you can enjoy whatever else you want there. So it's not so much an urgency to come back for the second season, just hoping you will find it, because outside of those big shows, they don't do a great deal of publicity to find, you know, I mean, obviously Travelers is not really their show, but like, for example, we always talk about Travelers, second season or third season of Travelers or one of those, they just don't get the same level of publicity. And so yeah, that's just part of the deal when you're a creator and you get that big check for one of these streamers. I love the fact that there's so many issues to talk about in TV, but it's this second season thing is real, and obviously Sneaky Pete came out today. We'll see how that does.
I'll tell you something that I have noticed is that the services do sometimes have different philosophies about this, and it's weird because sometimes you're talking about interaction design. This is like a computer industry concept more than it is a television industry concept. But like Hulu, I really admire how Hulu puts the shows that you've put on your watch list at front and center and tries to intuit like what you might want to watch next. So if you've got like three or four Hulu shows that you're watching, and you get to the end of one, and those shows are spooling out week by week and not in a binge, you know, you get to the end of Runaways, and it may say, you know what, but we do have a new episode of this other show you like, and you could watch that right now. And now you're binging different Hulu shows instead of binging one show on Hulu. And that's something that I know Netflix has this My List concept, which they've had since they were a movie service, and most of the things on My List are like movies that I said I wanted to watch 8 years ago that occasionally will bob back up onto the service. But right. Like, that's the other thing that I think where again, Netflix has all the data, so maybe they don't care and they've got their own strategy. But as a viewer, I would like it if I could pick all my Netflix shows and say, yes, I want to watch these. And they would be a very clear place where Netflix would basically be like taking me by the hand and saying, hey, a year ago you said you liked Jessica Jones and now it's back. And so we're going to play that for you now, like a little bit more than me having to forage for it. And honestly, I think as a computer industry person, I look at this and I say, I think this is a failure of the Netflix product design, that they are growing so quickly and they have so much content that they're trying to push out there. And my gut feeling is the way that their apps are built is not keeping up with the volume. Mm-hmm. It's not designed to deal with such a huge avalanche of content and making it navigable for people. Beyond right. like the featured on and trending kind of lists, I think it kind of falls down. And Hulu, I've noticed, seems to be at least a little bit better about that. And Amazon, we've already talked about. Amazon's got its own issues too with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's some structural issues about keeping people engaged. Viewer engagement is a huge deal.
Like, and I want to subscribe to a show. I literally want to make a list of my shows and promote something into my shows and then have on Netflix or Amazon or whatever, like the first thing I see when I come there is if there's unwatched episodes of the shows that I've said I liked, I want them front and center. And I get why Netflix wants me to kind of like flip around and see all the other things that Netflix offers. That's fine, but there is that thing, like, they could do, if Netflix wanted to really do more in terms of bridging the gap between seasons and knowing that you watch that show and floating it up, they could do as much as they want to do because they know all that stuff. They have the power to do it. It's just a question of, do they care, or would they rather focus on marketing the next thing for you? I don't know, but there's some tech there for them, if they want to go. Let's talk about Sneaky Pete. You mentioned it a few times. Season two, Sneaky Pete. I know you've got a review forthcoming, and you liked season one. How's season two?
Well, I think that there's I just quickly, because I'm going to forget this thought because my brain is mush right now. But I think that you're right in that.
Did you just Columbo me? Is that what just happened?
I just did. I Columboed you on your own theory.
Okay.
I would welcome. I mean, obviously, email is so old school, but like, you know, and it's just people are not always going to give out their phone numbers to be texted or something like that. But the next generation certainly will or might. I would love periodic reminders of a show over a season. Like, if they could get buy-in from, and it's certainly a generational thing, but if they could get buy-in for access to, to sort of prompt you, like, can you imagine? Once a month you get like a, let's just take Sneaky Pete. Once a month you get a picture of Pete and he's like, he's in the woods somewhere. He's like, hey, Jason, that'd be great. Right. Like, you might eventually get annoyed, but if there's only one a month, and it says like, hey, Jason. And then underneath it says returns on X date.
Yeah.
You know, something like that is the future of engagement.
Yeah, and in some places they're doing that. I think you see on some Facebook pages and some Twitter pages for very specific brands, you do see that. I follow a few show Twitter accounts, mm-hmm. and whoever the social media people who are in charge of that, they can do a pretty good job of keeping in your face, even in the off season, like the BBC America Doctor Who account and the BBC Doctor Who account have done a pretty good job of like, here's an animation of a clip from last season that was fun. And like, this episode is rerunning this weekend and here's some casting news for next season. And like, just keep the drumbeat going. The Star Trek Discovery Twitter account is doing, has made an effort to do that too. It'll be interesting to see how they stretch it out out now that they've got like a year probably before they before they're back. But like, you can do it. There can be a drumbeat, but people who are watching have to kind of opt in to that. And I think there is an art to it where it stops feeling like spam, and it feels more like kind of a happy reminder that this is a show you like and that it will be back at some point.
Right. I mean, no one's going to want total push notification and access to their to all their devices. But again, if you have to follow these people on Twitter or Instagram to get those things. So there's somewhere in the future, engagement will be better. But as far as like season two of Sneaky Pete.
Yes, I've got my picture of Pete here. He sent it from the woods. How's Pete?
He's in the woods. I'm back, Jason. I tell you what, I really liked the first season, obviously. I think they pulled off a little bit of a miracle there in that the casting was really great in that show. And Bryan Cranston as the Heavy was good. And then having this idea that it's a long con and Giovanni Ribisi gets caught in all these tense filled things trying to complete this con, that kind of, despite the fact that a couple of episodes were total wheel spinning and you just couldn't, you know, it felt slow. There was always kind of forward momentum, and it just conceptually that first season was very well done. Second season, when you don't have Cranston there, is for me a little bit of a struggle, because what seemed novel last or 14 months ago or whatever, it seems less novel now. And I don't mean this to be denigrating, and I wrote that in my review. Sneaky Pete is really a network TV show, and it's structured like one. It's structured like you are totally about to bail on them for a commercial or at the commercial, even though there aren't commercials. And they just, they're so frightful of that, that they create these constant series of, you know, twisty elements that would only happen in the most improbable way. You really have to let your mind, you know, just go with it. And I think that was fine in the first season. The second season, I have to tell you, Jason, I was overwhelmed by the sense of like, oh my God, so many bad decisions are being made here. And, you know, you're cranking up the tension in so many ways. It's not necessary. Just let me find out more about these people. Let them sit down and have a discussion without, somebody has to get on the phone to call where you are and get you out of a jam. Somebody has to show up impersonating another person to get you out of a jam. You left all your money in a backpack, and then that backpack got taken by a kid to school. And then when you get to school, you find out that another kid with a pink backpack went home and they took your backpack full of money. You know, that show is just filled with stuff like that. It's just enough. Like, you know, it's like, I found myself kind of like pulling my hair out a little bit. It was like, just when you're free of this one gigantic problem that we created and then we put to bed, we want it to come back again because they're transferring the case to this office and they're sending a new investigator, you know, and then like there's a thing where like this whole one of the storylines is completely wrapped up with a bow, and then now it's like, I'm missing a headlight. Did my headlight come out at the crime scene? And he's like, oh, please, people. I mean, it's too much. It's too much. So I think that in the old school network vein, there's a lot of people who are like, I love it. I love the fact that these networky characters are in such a state of panic. What will they do? I think people who are a little more sophisticated in their storytelling from like, you know, I would say like a counterpart on Stars, they're going to look at that show and go like, God, you guys got to settle the hell down, man. You got a lot of agitation going on for no reason. And that was my general feeling. So I basically wrapped it up by saying, hey, if you like being manipulated and agitated in kind of old school network way, come back for season two. But if not, then season one was kind of perfectly enough, and then you can move on.
All right. We have one more show to talk about, which is not on for a couple weeks, but I know you're reviewing it because it's premiering at South by Southwest. We might as well mention it. It's Barry on HBO.
Yeah, and it'll go up later today. I don't know if we'll have a chance to get this show notes, but it'll go up later today on the site. I think we're just waiting for the like 6 p.m. embargo, so probably 3 o'clock our time. Or if you're in Australia, it's tomorrow or whatever
yeah,
day
it's already
it is.
Out. It's been yeah, already it's been already released. Out. Yeah, sure.
It's already been panned. Now, I have to tell you, Barry, this is an interesting story. I'll try to go through this thing really quickly, but I almost never, if a show does not catch me in the first few episodes, my standard rule of thumb is like, I'm moving on, because that's what a regular non-professional reviewer would do. Like, if you're just a watcher, if you're in the general population and, hey, here's a new show and it doesn't hook you, you're gone. That's just the way of life.
Yep.
I don't care if anybody in the business believes that or not. It is totally true. And the numbers bear it out.
But Tim, episode 7 is really good. It starts to get good.
It turns around.
You just have to watch 6 hours of bad stuff and then it's all good from there.
I love it. But, and then in this particular case, just so people understand the concept, it's a comedy and it's from Bill Hader. Everybody knows Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live. Documentary Now, all of that stuff. And it's from Alec Berg, who did Silicon Valley. Of course, he created that, but he also wrote for Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. So these guys are total comedy background. So they came up with a premise, like actually a couple of years ago, and they finally are just getting around to doing this, where Bill Hader is a war veteran, from Iraq. He's done time. He comes back a little shell-shocked and can't really find a job. And so he kind of half-heartedly falls into this role where he's manipulated by Steven Root, great character actor, to become an assassin. So there's your story. You've got an assassin in Cleveland who gets assigned to hit job in Los Angeles to shoot this aspiring actor. He gets out to Los Angeles and falls in love with acting, and then there's your comedy, and he wants to be an actor. He doesn't want to be an assassin anymore. So perfectly fine premise for comedy, and the first couple of episodes are ridiculous and they're funny, but what they're trying to do is what Fargo is trying to do, and very few series can do this, which is manage comedy and like ultra violence. So I think in the back of their minds, specifically Hader, he wanted to transition like in a Bill Murray kind of way into a more dramatic actor. And he saw this as a chance in maybe like a Fargo-esque kind of way to put in a really dramatic performance in something that's still very funny. But as I've said many times, that is really hard to do. Those tones are hard to balance. And so the first few episodes of Barry on HBO really get the tone completely wrong. It's almost all comedy. And then it's this shocking hitman violence that doesn't fit at all. And so I was, in the first few episodes, I was kind of dreading that. Although I have to say that the dramatic parts were really interesting. Okay. So now cut to like, I'll watch one more episode. And I got to tell you, that show, even though it still has that tonal imbalance, and I think that they kind of accidentally got that part of it right because they were clearly toying with it. But what happens in Barry, Jason, is that it takes off. And it makes a beeline. It only has 8 episodes. It makes a beeline to the finish and really commits full time to being super dramatic, surprisingly dramatic, very, very violent, filled with these tense emotional moments, really big surprises in the storytelling, and yet also has this element of comedy to it. And I don't think they really ever really got the balance right, but at some point, this hybrid that they created is like nothing you've seen on TV. And I think that my feeling in my gut is they were like, you know what? They shot a couple episodes and they thought, you know what? We're not there, but let's just do the show we really want to do and let's go for it. And if we don't get picked up, whatever, at least we put it on. It's in the history books. And I think they made a mad dash for this story of this hitman turns actor and his sort of existential crisis. And they end up with a great series. Like it's really weird and completely unexpected. I don't know where they're going to go in the second season. I watched all 8 episodes and they still have this lingering problem of this tonal clash that they don't quite get right. But they also have in the end, a pretty interesting amalgamation of tones, and their strong suit is Bill Hader being dramatic and the violence part. So there's something there that's, I don't know if it'll work long term, but they've got something that I haven't seen on TV in a long time.
Well, I think that's interesting. What you said is that not like the first episodes are bad, that they're funny, but there's like weird tonal problems, and then there's a tonal shift that happens when it finally kicks it into gear. It's not quite the same as saying, well, the first few episodes aren't good. It's just that they're kind of weird and not representative of where the show ends up.
Yeah, they're actually very funny, because you end up having these two. Henry Winkler, by the way, has delivered, I think, an Emmy-winning performance. I mean, he was so good on Arrested Development. It's like the Arrested Development Barry Peppercorn role times like 10, because he's playing an acting coach who wrote a book, and he's pompous, but he's actually not a very good actor at all, of course. And everybody who comes to his class are not very good actors. The irony is that like he actually really knows the craft of acting, and he teaches it excellently. He's just not a good actor, and most of the people who come to see him aren't actors. And of course, you know, one of those is going to be Bill Hader, and they're sort of sending up the idea of the audition process and being an actor in LA, and some of that is hysterically funny. But just when you're laughing at that, they'll cut to a hit, and like you're thinking, am I watching like Homeland? It's like it takes this incredibly dramatic turn, and so it's really funny in its parts, but I think eventually what gets more interesting is the drama part, and then they'll throw in they'll have these like terrorist people, and then one of them will randomly be super off the charts sitcom-y wacky neighbor character, and you're like, oh my god, what is even happening here? It's kind of a hot mess. But it does really get good. And when they kind of embrace the darker side, I think the show gets better. So, again, I think it's an experiment that kind of blew up in the lab. But the end results are like, wow, that's a really interesting fire.
All right. That's good. So that's not out for a little bit, right?
It's I highly recommend it. It's not out until March 25th. It's Barry. It's getting its South by Southwest international premiere today, so we'll see.
All right, before we go, we have a few letters with some follow-up over things we've talked about, but before we do that, I wanted to give you a counterpart check-in. I know you've seen the whole thing. I'm now up to episode 7, which is the one that aired last Sunday, called The Sincerest Form of Flattery, and I will say again, I watched this one, and I said, knowing that you already had placed it at the top of the power rankings, and this episode, I just was like, yeah, that is, there you go. This is the best thing going right now, because that episode, which takes a character who has only had minor scenes prior and that we haven't really known a lot about, and then there's sort of information about them, kind of a revelation that happens at the very end of episode 6, and then it tells an entire story about that character with very little intercutting back. There is some, and it's very dramatic, cutting back to sort of the present day, but we get this past flashback of this character. It is, I read an article that talked about this particular actor, and when they were recruited for this, this part of the story was explained to them that they would be in the background for a while, and then in episode 7 it would be their episode, and it's spectacular. I'm just saying it again.
You did a great job of being very coy.
I was trying to not give it away. Well, that is a beautiful moment at the end of episode 6, where you're like, oh, like there's a realization of these characters that I'll put it this way: there are two characters. Just the irony of the fact that this is a show about one person who turns out to be more than one person. There is the case where there are two people you think are two different people, and then you get a moment of realization where you are like, oh, you connect those dots, and it's the same person. It's been the same person all along. The show just hasn't shown that to you. It's very good. And then to talk about fully exploring your premise, episode 7 does that. So I'm looking forward to the last 3. I'll be sad when it's over, but I love it when there's an episode that kind of dunks. Just like, oh my god, that was such a great single episode. I feel like there was an episode of The Magicians actually this season that was a little bit like that too, where a couple of characters essentially like live their entire lives and grow old and die, and then there's magic and it all gets kind of undone, but it was such a beautiful, kind of amazing, fully committed episode. I'm very impressed when shows have a standout. You know, there's I like this show, and that was an episode of this show, and then there's that was a legitimately brilliant episode of television, and Counterpart did that with episode 7 for sure.
Totally agree.
Amazing. Okay, some letters. Let's do it. Letters and tweets we've got. From Tim Windsor on Twitter. Said, Tim mentioned the pretty darn good Netflix Ozark, but said it was shot in the actual Ozarks. There's some second unit stuff, some location stuff in the Ozarks, but the bulk of it is shot in the Vancouver of the South, Greater Atlanta. Soon everything will be shot here. Maybe it may be true.
Yeah, the secondary, like all the overhead stuff and some of the lake stuff, right. is probably, yeah, but all right. And that's then, I just meant like put setting it in place. Yeah, right. I probably misspoke. But setting it in place there.
Mm-hmm. Of the south.
That's genius.
Also, Americron on Twitter wrote in from the 631 to say, what do you think? Is this ever going to happen? Will it change the quality of broadcast shows? And it's a story from the Wall Street Journal headlined, Fox wants to reduce ad time to 2 minutes per hour by 2020. I laughed at this because Fox already tried this. They tried this in the Dollhouse, I want to say, era, where they had their premium, or was it Firefly? It was that era where they had their premium shows that were going to have more running time, and they were going to have reduced commercial breaks with that presumably the sponsors were going to be charged more for, but it didn't last very long. And they're trying again, Tim.
Yeah, I find that just I read the story with that space on, and I was like, whoa, I'm stunned that that's they know they have to have like more and better engagement. Let's just put it this way. I have no end to my admiration of people in the ad business who say, okay, look, we're losing viewers. And we were charging you this amount of months for all these viewers. Now we've lost three quarters of them. We're going to raise your rates.
Yeah.
And we're going to just show a little bit. But that little bit is like premium. And so you're going to pay a premium for that. I'm like, the audaciousness of the people in this business is amazing. But I guess it's good to have something like that have your back, because I don't know how they're going to sell otherwise. We're in a world where nobody wants to watch advertising, and I understand that.
Yeah, it's a tough one, especially for, I mean, outside of things like with natural breaks, like sports, things where people need to watch it immediately so they'll sit through the ads. It's that much harder for anybody to sit through these ads. I do worry that the future of commercial TV is going to be like two boxes. There's going to be the box with your show in it, and there's going to be the box with the ad in it, and they're just going to run simultaneously. It's essentially like, or one of those lower third things will just pop up and it'll never go away. Just full of ad stuff that keeps popping up while your show is also playing. I don't know, but I think the funny thing is they literally did this already. They cut back on a couple of shows and tried this, and the answer was they made less money because there's a rate per number of viewer, and reducing the ad load doesn't really increase the number of viewers, and you can do the math. I am shocked when I've been watching an episode of The Incomparable. I've been rewatching The Prisoner, and like watching the original Star Trek, you watch these shows from the 60s and they're all like these hour long shows, and they're all like 52 minutes long. So there's like 8 minutes of ads, and now there's like 18 minutes of ads per hour. Mm-hmm. So, and it sucks. I get that it sucks, but the reason that happens is just economically, that's the way that they make their money. And if they cut it in half, they don't double their rate. It doesn't work like that, because the people aren't paying for load, they're paying for eyeballs, the people watching the shows, and that doesn't change. If twice as many people watched a show with half the ads, that's what we would get, but that doesn't happen, so it's not gonna happen.
Yeah, it's and you know what, I officially, I know we always get some of these questions about advertising and all that stuff, but I officially stopped caring about that part of it when last summer, when the broadcast television industry said, we are making money.
We turned the dinosaur ship.
Yeah, we turned it around. We have fewer viewers, like a lot fewer viewers, but we turned it around, and we've monetized not just overnight ratings or even live plus three or even live plus seven. We've monetized the whole damn month. And I was like, okay, I don't know how you're doing it. I don't know if you're making the same amount of money, but they all crowed that they were financially solid. And to me, that was like, I now wash my hands of ever caring about the state of the broadcast business. You guys do you, because you're making shows I don't really care about except for the comedies, and I'm going to focus over here.
Well, and hey, if Fox can reduce commercial load and they feel like there is something that will allow them to have better engagement and the ad space will be premium and whatever else, so that in the end they're fine economically with it, then great, because I think mm-hmm. everybody would like a lower ad load. I don't believe right. that it's real, but yes, that would be great. If they can figure that out, more power to them, because nobody likes having 18 minutes of ads per hour.
Agreed.
It's not good. It's not good. And I think you're right. The more people stream stuff, the less willing to see ads they are. Even when I was watching a Simpsons episode the other day, because I watched the Prisoner episode of The Simpsons for this Prisoner thing I'm doing. Uh-huh. And I watched that on FX, where they do pre-roll and mid-roll ads for all the Simpsons episodes. If you want to watch them on demand, even if you've got a cable login, they're going to run some ads. But what I noticed is, they're like super apologetic about running an ad. And I think, well, geez, an ad, three 30-second ads, that is an ad load of 3 minutes per hour. And on a web browser, you're that concerned about 3 minutes per hour when regular TV is 18 minutes per hour. I think that says something about maybe how it is untenable to have that an ad load that size, because there's going to be just nobody who is willing to sit through it. Like we used to, I mean, you remember the old days. I remember we used to just like go to the bathroom and go fix yourself a sandwich during the ad breaks. It's not like we were watching them. They were long enough that you could just do stuff while the ads ran. So people never liked them, but now nobody wants to see them.
Yeah, once you were given an alternative, and nobody even really wants to do, you know, I think that, well, look, it's an economic issue, and we talk about this a lot, where, you know, sometimes I in particular forget that, like, a lot of people can't afford the no ads on Hulu part, right. So they have to sit through the ads. But, like, I do know that people don't want that either. And if given their druthers, and if they can have the economic ability to not have it, people will not have advertising, but they'll pay a premium to not have it. And then they have to figure out a way to use that premium to put shows on the air and, you know, and have a budget to create content. So it's up to them to figure it out.
Yep. It's true. Definitely. We are certainly going to a world that's going to be bifurcated by people who have enough money will not have to see the ads. And the people who can't afford that are going to be forced to sit through ads. And that's mm-hmm. not cool, but that's the economics of it. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple dubbing letters. The dubbing story continues. This might wrap it up, but it's a couple of good ones. This one is from former intern Blair from the 925, now living in the 415. Blair used to be my intern at Macworld, and he is now a professional journalist in the tech industry. And Blair wrote in, regarding the ongoing conversation about dubbing, I have some good news and bad news from the field of AI. Right now, companies like Adobe are building systems that can be trained to speak like an actual human, given enough audio of that person speaking. Similarly, there are other systems that are able to morph faces and video footage given enough training data. All that adds up to a future where we could conceivably have automatic dubbing of videos based on video morphing, speech generation, and translation algorithms. I expect it'll be several years off from widespread use because the existing systems are far from perfect and don't scale well, but these capabilities are definitely coming. Adobe is already marketing its AI text-to-speech software as a sort of computer-generated ADR. That's for automated dialogue recording, like looping, they call it. That is a fascinating idea, that in the future you might end up with that French show that wants to come onto Netflix in the US, and that Netflix just does a dub version where not only is it dubbed, but the mouths match the English.
Ooh. Wow.
That's amazing. And it might even be done entirely by computers. Maybe, maybe not. The bad news. Now, Blair did say it was good news, bad news. The bad news, I'm going to guess the bad news is that we're all going to die in an AI revolt, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the bad news is the same tech that could create amazing dubs will also be used to create deep fake pornography of celebrities and could be used in the future to make videos of people saying and doing things they never did, which would further undermine whatever fragile concept of reality we have left in this era of alternative facts. So, you know, trade-offs. Love to your mother's former intern, Blair.
Well, I'll get another love to your mother's. Oh, yeah. Wow.
He knows. Okay. Blair. Oh, Blair's making the deep references. Blair knows.
Oh, okay. Wow.
That's,
okay.
Anyway, that's good. So, you know, trade-offs. Good, good
that
job.
That is a great letter. Great letter.
All right. This is from Hannah, previously of the too many zip codes to list, currently in the plus 33. Spain. So she says, in Spain, all foreign TV and movies are dubbed by default. There are historical reasons for this. Lack of original Spanish content in the first half of the last century. The dictatorship of Franco. Still dead, by the way. The high rate of illiteracy in Spain for most of the last century. Starting from the last one, literacy was something only the upper classes had access to. To learn to read, you had to have parents who could afford to send you to Catholic schools and didn't need you to work or help in the family business. It was a pretty small overlap. When I was growing up in the 80s, it came as a real shock to me to realize many adults I knew couldn't read or count. People who can't read still like going to the pictures, though, so dubbing was the solution. Franco, a main reason behind his move to formalize the dubbing of all foreign media, was to ease the censoring of content. The most famous version of this was the film Mogambo, where censors changed the relationship between two characters from husband and wife to siblings so that the adultery plotline was instead just about temptation. Another reason was to create an industry that employed a lot of people. There are even annual awards for best dubbing, and the voice actors are a big deal. More problematic is when, for example, the guy who always does the De Niro voices and the Pacino voices has to do the movie where they appear together. Finally, there was just plain old nationalism at the heart of the decision. Spain, Italy, France, and Germany all adopted defensive language laws in the 1930s or 40s to protect their citizens from foreign propaganda. Spanish dubbing is, across the board, terrible. As someone who speaks English and knows what the original performances are like, I can assure you they are uniformly, comically bad. The only thing I know of that can compare is this. And I have lost what that link is. Hannah, let me see what I got here. Okay, this is... Please stand by while
please
I...
Please stand by. Yeah, I think so. I do like how we're keeping people across the world on pins and needles.
The only thing, well, I'm going to edit this part out, is this. And she sent a link to a terrifying thing from the 1969 Oscars. Oh, that's a letdown. Anyway... I'll just say Spanish dubbing is across the board terrible. As someone who speaks English and knows what the original performances are like, I can assure you they're uniformly comically bad. Best to everyone's mothers, Hannah. Boy, Andrew in Ireland has really started something.
Everybody, he really got something going.
Everybody's
yeah.
given the best to everybody's mothers, and it's not even Mother's Day yet. Well, it's anyway, that's a great history lesson there from Hannah, and that is fascinating, and I get it. Like, doesn't that make sense? So, first off, literacy is a reason why you dub things in, and then social control is a reason that if you're in an oppressive government like Franco's Spain, you would do that. And then on top of that all is nationalism and trying to protect your language by getting the English stuff out of your national cinema. So, fascinating.
That is a great letter.
I feel like we're learning things here.
I know it's really dangerous,
which is not what we're supposed to be doing on podcasts, is learning facts about the world, not this podcast anyway. But thank you for your letters, everybody. podcast@tvtalkmachine.com is the place to send them, or you can tweet at us at TVTM, and those tweets are very long now, so you can get a whole idea single tweet. But that's about it. You got anything more? We done? We managed
it? I got nothing. Yeah, I got nothing. I got a lot of TV to watch, yeah. Basically. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. See, you got nothing except, guess what? More television. And it never stops. All right, well, I hope people will send in some more letters and send some more love to more mothers. And until then, Tim, have a great weekend.
All right, you too.
Bye, everybody.